cab drivers. Watch your cars.
Welcome back to Action RC, the podcast series taking you inside RC racing both now and across the 40 plus years of its history. Before we dive into today's show, a couple of quick notes for some big races that we're going to be involved in here in Australia over the next few months. Chargers RC 10th scale off-road carnival in early July. The club just put down a new track this week. Looks fantastic. Entries are open for that. Followed fairly shortly after by the Asia Buggy Championships, round two of that Scotty Ernst series. Brand new track also going down for that at Pine Hills in Brisbane, Australia, and just a few spots left. And the third one, the Vintage Bash, the big Australian event for Vintage Off-Road RC, coming up later in the year in Melbourne in November. And the club starting, or the organisers starting to release some details about classes for that event. So early November, Melbourne Vintage Cars will be on. All right, let's put all that aside. Today on the show is a man who for the better than a decade was widely regarded as one of the very best on the planet, scooping four officially, four and a half, five IFMA World Championship wins across three different classes, ranking him in the top five all-time World Championship winners. Add to that somewhere over a dozen European Championships, countless other race wins. He was and is a household RC name, drove for some of the biggest manufacturers on the planet, and continues to be involved in the industry today. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome David Spashit to the show. David, welcome. How are you this fine evening?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm not too bad. It's a little early in the morning here for me, but the sun's shining and my dog's kind of sitting here right by my lap, so life is good. Life is good.
Good stuff.
Mate, there are a whole bunch of things I want to explore with you, from your development as a driver, but of course those massive international events, industry and people you met along the way. And I do want to dig in a little bit to where things are in 12 scale and maybe even touring car racing today. But before we do all of that, let's kind of lay the groundwork and get right back to the beginning. It's the question I always start with, which is what's your origin story, your RC origin story? How did this thing get started for you?
Very simply, there was an RC club started up just across the road from where we lived.
Oh, really? That's close.
walking distance, 100 yards. And my dad had just been made redundant.
Okay.
He was looking for something to do. We saw this RC car club, and my dad saw a lot of opportunities to start a model shop.
Okay.
That didn't happen straight away, the model shop, of course, because obviously we needed to learn a bit, but we started racing.
Mm.
It was on polished wood floor, if you remember, with the Lexan chassis and silicon tires and all that type of stuff.
So we're way back here, right? We're back in the early to mid 1980s somewhere, is that right?
Yeah, early 80s. Early 80s, that would have been. And that's where it all grew and started from.
I mean, there are people all around listening to this going, oh, a racetrack 100 metres from my house, how good would that be?
if it was a permanent facility, yeah, lovely. But no, when you've got to lay the track out every week or whatever, but it was, I remember going there as a kid. I remember running there and my dad would get there early to help set the track up. If we forgot something, I could run home and get it. It was pretty cool. Pretty cool.
And that's a particular era where the cars were made of polycarbonate, weren't they? Or Lexan, folded Lexan, all sorts of things. There was a Schumacher car. There were all sorts of chassis all around the world being built and raced in that style at that time. There was actually an Australian built car, the only proper race car that's ever been built in Australia, called a TE4 or something like that.
I think it was even before Schumacher even released their first car, to be honest.
Yeah.
It really was, really, yeah.
So
I can't even remember what we were running, if I'm honest.
And so how long did it take to sort of get to the point where your dad could open the store and that side of things kicked off for him?
I think it was late 80s, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
He started with Intronics.
Okay.
We started building chargers and dischargers for batteries, you know, peak detect chargers, thermal chargers, all that stuff, all the NiCads and stuff. Electronic speed controllers then, which were just basically relays, you know, forward, brake, reverse type of stuff. That was all kind of revolutionary back then, and my dad was on the ground making it all work. So that's how he started Intronics, and that was his career for quite a few years.
Hmm. it certainly was a name that was well around. So, I mean, on the racing side, how, you know, what was the development like for you? You're obviously a pretty young fella at that stage. You were just going racing with your dad. Did you start to travel around the country to other clubs fairly quickly?
Not really, to be honest. Being a kid, my dad kept me at home for a while.
Yeah.
But then I think when I was around 10, 11, we started going to slightly bigger events and my dad would start taking me with him. And obviously when it became his business, it was in his interest a little bit to have me there to help him.
Yeah.
Because he used to race as well. So he was racing and we would take a shop track side. And we started off locally doing a few more events. And back in the day in England, there was a lot of local clubs that you could go to.
Mm.
So you didn't really have to travel that far to get to the next club. And I remember those times, they were really, really good. But of course, being so young, schoolwork, all that type of stuff, I could only go if there was no school the next day or it was holidays or something. I wasn't able to go every night of the week like my dad could if he wanted to. So there were limitations to what I could do.
So I guess I'm probably not really going out on much of a limb here, but I've spoken to a couple of guys from the US who started in 12 scale in that sort of similar era, Rick Howard, Joel Johnson being, you know, a couple of guys who you would go head to head with years later. And there in the US and here in Australia, it was 12 scale was all, you know, tarmac, bitumen, parking lot kind of racing. I'm guessing in the UK with weather and all sorts of things, that wasn't what it was like. You talked about those kind of silicon tires on timber floors. I'm guessing it was all indoors and all sorts of different surfaces.
Yeah, I never actually, in the early days, I never actually raced outside. There were a few events done outside for 12 scale, but the majority of all of it was done on polished wood floor, your normal school halls, village halls, whatever it was. And then we used to get a foam tire, believe it or not, and actually roll silicon onto the foam tire to create a tread pattern. And then as the night went on, the silicon line would come up, much like it does on carpet, and then the grip would come up to a degree, and that's what we used to race on.
And away you'd go.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Always 12 scale as a young fella? Like there was no temptation to go play on the grass or the AstroTurf? Probably was grass in those days, off-road?
Yeah. I mean, again, we did do some off-road. Again, local club racing, keeping everything local. I remember having a Tamiya fast attack vehicle. We all had frogs and hornets and that type of stuff and hot shots. I remember having all of those as a kid racing at the local club. But for my dad, it was all, the emphasis for him was always the on-road stuff, not so much the off-road.
Like every kid, every 15-year-old kid in the world in 1986 had a hotshot or a hornet or a frog, didn't they? It was
exactly kind of how it was. However, we all wish now we kept them, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Oh, the cars I've given away or sold very cheaply over the years.
Yes. Anyway,
too bad. So, David, tell me about then kind of growing into the more, I guess, competitive sort of side of things, you know, starting to, I mean, I've seen your dad's name in results. I'm assuming it was your dad in results from the 1988 12 scale worlds that, you know, presumably the business is up and running by then, but you must have started to kind of, you know, into the late 80s, start to build your own sense of competitiveness and, you know, trying to go chase race wins around the place. Were you good straight away or did it kind of take, you know, quite a few years to develop into that competitive sort of driver?
I was very, obviously with my dad with the shop, I was very lucky because I was always surrounded by knowledgeable people. So they would always steer me in the right direction, help out when I got stuck. And I was always quite good. I always felt I was quite good at just watching. Because all the answers were around you. You just had to watch what they were doing, see if they would do something different, how they would prepare something, how they would charge a battery, for example, or mount a body shell, or, you know, forwards or backwards, or how they would true their tires. I was quite studious in that regard of just watching what people were doing. And the big break really for my dad and myself was when my dad's company, Intronics, took on Corelli. That was kind of the first major stepping stone in my career, to be honest.
Okay.
I'd raced nationals before that with Schumacher C car and that type of stuff. But when the Corelli thing really happened, that's when we kind of really decided, do you know what, we're going to go racing now and we're going to do this properly and we're going to put a team together. And And that's when I felt my development really started to take off. Was I good from the beginning? Hell no. hell no. And honestly, at the time when you do something, I think I was totally and utterly naive of what you could do.
Yeah.
So I was just enjoying it for what it was, you know, loving it for what it was, just enjoying going to Oscar racing at local clubs or Sunday meetings or wherever we went and just loving it. Just couldn't get enough of it. Was in my workshop or dad's workshop the day after a race, cleaning it all, getting it ready. I remember doing all of that as a kid. Was I thinking about winning anything? Probably not. Just enjoying it for what it was.
I'm always caught by things that people say. And there's a couple of interesting things you've said already, you know, in the last couple of minutes. One is pointing to the, you know, I think you used the word luck of, you know, growing up with the dad that you grew up with and, you know, with the business kind of that was there around you. And the second thing that I really liked that kind of that a sense of noticing or paying attention, watching, learning carefully, kind of seeing what other people are doing. And, you know, those, I mean, luck is a funny thing, but, you know, it is the circumstance you were in. And then, but really paying attention to maximize and make the most of the opportunities that you saw and you could kind of learn from the people around you.
100%. You know, and I still do that today, really. I'll sit at my desk at Nationals when I've done them or any events recently, and I'll sit there and I'll just watch, and you just look at what people are doing, and then you listen to their comments after their run, and you've kind of watched what they've done and you've seen their result. Does that help me on race day? Well, yeah, because if they find something that's better and you saw what they did, happy days. If you saw what they did and it was bad, you go, yeah, well, I kind of knew that was going to happen and I won't be trying that either myself. So you can kind of watch and learn quite a lot of stuff in the pits and just watching trackside too. Just watching lines, watching people drive, see what they're up to. You can learn quite a lot before you've even driven your own car. But as I already said as well, I was very, very fortunate to be surrounded by a very good group of racers and people that are still friends today. And they really helped my development.
Who are some of those people, David, if you've got names on the tip of your tongue?
Yeah, well, the main one that still I'm friends with today is a guy called David Gale. He helped my dad with Corelli.
Yep.
Back in the day, he was always kind of sat next to me when we would go racing. He ended up being just as mad as I am today. But he was also very studious at looking at the facts of what was going on, then maximizing the potential of those opportunities. So he was very, very good. And of course, being part of the Corelli team when Oscar Janssen came over, for example, an incredible driver, very, very talented, very, very good with motors and batteries and stuff. That was a bit further on. But again, you learn from that man, Brush Motors. You're learning from one of the all-time greats of that era. So again, you're just very, very fortunate, really, to be around those type of people. But those two in particular, they really helped me greatly.
Fantastic. And so as you start to, you know, compete at that national and starting to get into the international level, you're racing with people like that. Who are the competitors, I guess, the people that you are chasing and racing against?
So in the UK, Phil Davis was the man to beat at the time.
Yeah.
I would go to a national as a kid and I would just watch.
Yeah.
Just watch him drive. And he was just, it looked effortless. It just looked completely effortless. It looked like everybody else was trying and it just looked like he was on a Sunday drive because he was wasting no energy. And of course, as we all know, 8 minutes back then, run time was the big key issue. Getting to the end of the run was just, you could do a perfect run, but if the battery didn't make it, it was all wasted. And he just seemed to know. He just seemed to know his limits and know what he can do. And he would always make sure he did the best he could do. So it was for you to beat him, not him to beat himself. And when I learned that from him, I realized that I was beating myself and I need to stop beating myself and just be the best I can be and make sure I maximize what I've got and then let other people beat me, not the other way around, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah. And I guess, you know, having really only watched your career from afar and, you know, in magazines and videos and things, but that would be a characteristic that I guess I would I would see in, you know, in the over the rest of your career, that, you know, paying attention to what you can see, managing what's within your hands to manage, and, you know, maximizing every opportunity.
And that's what it was all about. I mean, the equipment was quite limiting. Obviously, with batteries, you have limited capacity.
Yes. Yeah.
Motors were all hand wound. So again, it was for you to figure out what you're doing, spring tension, brush compound, timing, gearing, driving style, all of those type of things. You had to try and get the best out of everything. So with that mindset, also, I realized quite early on that I could win meetings Monday to Friday, not necessarily on a Sunday.
Say some more about that. Yeah.
Well, that's just being prepared. Just making sure that when I turned up on Sunday, I was ready to race, not ready to prepare my race stuff. So I would make sure that I had batteries ready. I would have tires cut. I would have spare body shells mounted. I would have whatever I needed for that day's racing ready. So all I'm worried about is putting the pieces of the puzzle together to race that day, not prepare the pieces of the puzzle to put on the car. And to me, that just made my day a lot easier. Because as if you remember, you know, cutting comms every single run, rebuilding a motor every single run.
Oh, it was hideous.
It was hideous. It wasn't. It was kind of enjoyable at a certain point. You know, for me, I found that a challenge, of course, because you've got to be ready. So luxury, maybe, potentially. When I found a good motor, a certain wind or something, I had two. So you'd run them in pairs all the time. So you were never stressed. You were never thrashing. You were never worried. But just making sure I was prepared Monday to Friday, I think, got me more wins on a Sunday than my actual talent did, if that makes sense. I think I outperformed people because I was ready, whereas they were not.
There is an interesting kind of thing in this conversation we're having, which you've pointed to, which is that racing and being competitive is so much more than what happens on the racetrack, isn't it? Like, there's a whole lot about getting yourself in the right kind of group of people with the right equipment, with the right preparation, the right mindset, the right kind of mental kind of preparedness, if you like, and what happens on the racetrack.
Absolutely. But I think that has shifted quite a lot over the last few years. When brushless came along, brushless motors, brushless speedos, LiPo batteries, you can charge a LiPo 50 times, it runs the same. You can run a brushless motor for 24 hours straight and it doesn't change. A lot of it's become plug and play. My era of racing, nothing was plug and play. It was all build it, make it. That was the biggest difference.
We're fast forwarding 40 odd years here, but is that 35 years? Has that shifted the emphasis in preparation to the, you know, one of the things I notice about racing today is the very, very, very fine detail that goes into the chassis preparation and tuning, the tiniest little changes and the, you know, just needing to keep the car itself in an extraordinary high level of kind of tune, if you like, because you can't make so much difference on the electronic side, for example, so that, you know, all of that difference comes in tire preparation and chassis. Is that a bit different, or was that always, you know, you were still paying a lot of attention to setting up the car, preparing the tires, those sorts of things back in the day?
Yeah, we were still doing well, what we thought was as critical as we could back then, of course. I agree with your sentiment of today's racing. Because everybody can buy a 5-turn off the shelf or a 13.5 off the shelf and a battery that's the same as Mark Reinhardt runs. That preparation is simply money. It's simply buying the right equipment to go race the right class. Therefore, everything else becomes ultimately very, very critical. Very, very critical. Control tires then became a thing for touring car. So now all of a sudden, the only thing you've got left is the chassis setup and you personally. So that means, as you rightly say, critical setup on the car. And that's why you need to go and practice at tracks before big events to make sure that you are better than everybody else on that track. And that's the road that the racing's gone down. In the old days, there was probably a little bit less of that because of the amount of prep work you had to do for the equipment. So it just became a little harder to do all of that work. But yeah, it's definitely changed the last few years.
It's interesting that we're having this conversation on the eve of the warm-up race for the 10-scale off-road worlds in the US. You're right, you're making me kind of think about the extraordinary lengths that people will go to now to get to a particular racetrack to practice for a particular event. You would barely see anyone win a big event without having been there for a testing weekend or week or a warm-up event.
Yeah.
In the lead up to
it. Do you ever remember that happening in the old days? Do you ever remember that happening? No. People traveling to Singapore to practice for the 12 scale worlds or going to Grand Rapids to practice for it? No, it just didn't happen.
No, that's right.
It just didn't happen. You didn't even think about doing it.
No, you didn't. So David, we've just, we've kind of thrown off a little bit of international kind of stuff there. So let's talk a little bit about that. Tell me about when this kind of hobby, the sport, started to take you overseas. I've dug into world's records and, find you in a B final in Singapore in 1990. You must have been about 14 years old or something by that stage. But just give me a bit of a tour through starting to travel, starting to go, across to European championships or world's trips, those sorts of things.
Yeah, so I went to a Euros in Portugal when I was quite young. I remember going there. Massive experience for me. Enjoyed every single minute. Did terrible. I remember not doing particularly very well. But then on the we drove there, which was like, I don't know, stupid amount of 12, 13-hour drive or something silly. And I remember thinking to myself on the way back, you did badly because you changed everything. You didn't know what you were doing, so you changed everything. So that was a big learning curve for me, going to a bigger event. And then I suppose the breakthrough meeting for me really was Newcastle, Gateshead, north of England. They had a Euros and I finished fourth, I believe.
Okay. What year would that have been?
Pass.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Unfair question to that notice.
But that was probably the year when I got noticed by, obviously my dad was the Corelli importer. Obviously I was around those guys all the time, but then all of a sudden it was like, oh, okay, right. You're in the A final. Yeah. I'm in the A final. Then Jürgen Lautenbach paid a bit of attention as well.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden I had a bit of help with some motors and stuff from Jürgen. And that's really when it started, to be honest. That's when it was interesting to go and race at bigger events, European events, and be part of those teams. So that's when it started.
I think the notes that I have suggest that by 1992, at that Worlds in the US, you're finishing fourth. In 1993, you win your first Euros. I think it's over in France. So really that kind of couple of years through that early 90s must have been that period where you were building in kind of capacity and capability, but also confidence to be able to go and race with some of those guys. Is that how much was it skill development and product and technical, and how much of it is the mental side of you kind of knowing, hey, I belong here. I can race with these guys. That you talked about that event in Newcastle, being a moment where you went, okay, I'm here.
Yeah, kind of, as I said, it kind of started at a Euros before that in Austria when I got it all wrong.
Yes, yeah.
And I kind of scolded myself because I changed everything. And I changed everything because I panicked and realized I didn't be the best I could be. I let my, how can I put it? I was impatient. I should have just waited for me to become better, not try and work on everything else to be better. And then when we went to Gateshead, which must have been a year later or 2 years later, I can't remember. I went there with no expectation of doing well, just be the best I can be. And I remember saying that to my dad, and dad said, yeah, that's absolutely right. Just go there and race. You've done well at nationals. It's in the UK, same carpet, nothing's changed. Just go race, see where you end up. And I remember dad turning around to me at one point and went, well, that went all right then, didn't it? that's not too bad. And I think all of that just, as I said before, led me to believe, let other people try and beat me. I'm just going to be as fast as I can be. And if they can beat me, then great, I'll work harder. But I'm not going to let myself down anymore. I'm not going to let myself down by not being ready. And that was probably the breakout event for me, really.
Do you have a sense, David, of how conscious you were of the people that you were starting to race against internationally, you know, that you might only see once a year or twice a year or once every couple of years in the case of, say, the American crew? You know, were you someone who was kind of paying attention to who are the people from around the world that I'm trying to race against here? Or was it really just a case of, actually, I'm just going to do my own thing and whoever shows up, shows up? Are you conscious of who's coming?
Of course, when you've got... I remember my first trip to America and I went with Oscar. We're going to go race in America. Oh, wicked. Joel Johnson races there. That's awesome. Mike Blackstock races there. John Orr races there. Oh, excellent. Oh, crap. I've got to race those guys. But just stuck, as my dad said before I left, and I keep mentioning my dad, he has been there from the beginning. He's still there today. He just said, just be you. Just go and do what you do. Don't get flustered. Don't be silly. Just go race. I think we went to Cleveland and we did all right. We didn't do too bad. We didn't disgrace ourselves. First time racing four cell in America, I believe. But yeah, it was just, yes, I was aware of the Masami, Joel Johnson. Of course I was.
Yeah.
Of course I was. Was I worried about racing against them? No. I would probably say I was more excited because I wanted to race against them, because you always want to race against the best.
You do indeed. Yeah. I do. I think there's something extraordinary about racing against the very best people you can race against.
Absolutely. It's absolutely.
For me, one of the reasons why I'm not so much of a fan of the multiple classes of ability, I'd rather be all in with everybody. I'd rather be knowing that I'm 50th, racing with everybody than coming in the top 10 in clubman or whatever it might. Anyway, that's a philosophical debate we'll save for later. Let's talk about world championship racing in particular. And so 1994, you're just off the podium. 1992, apologies, you're just off the podium. In 1994, you take the first win of your world championship kind of career. I'd love to just hear you kind of reflect a little bit on what that event was like. You know, I think we're in Paris, in France, for that event in 1994. You take the win. Joel Johnson is second. Masami is third. I don't know of a more iconic kind of trio of on-road races, maybe ever. You know, in terms of a podium, David, just reflect on that event for me. Tell me what it was like going there, how the event went, you know, and what it was like to kind of stand on the top step.
That's the only RC racing picture you'll find in my house.
Okay.
Because that's how much that event meant to me and my dad, was to get that first. It was really, really hot that weekend. Everybody was there. Ernie was there. Reedy was there. All the teams were there. It was all guns blazing, as it were. Everybody was throwing the kitchen sink at everything.
Yeah.
And I remember going over to Holland and we were at the Dordrecht test track, the Corelli test track, and we were practicing. And we found a few things that made quite a big advantage. And we had a good feeling going into that event that if we can capitalize on these small details, it's going to be quite an advantage come race day. And that, for me, that will, yes, winning it for myself, brilliant, fantastic, but also the amount of effort, Constant Paul, Casey's father, all of the Corelli factory, Oscar especially, the amount of effort they all personally put into me that weekend, I can't thank them enough because they gave me every single opportunity, everything I needed. I couldn't have wanted for any more support from a team. So that wasn't just me up there on my own. That was a whole group of us that made that happen. So that for us was really pretty cool.
I mean, at this stage, you've been racing 10 years, you know, and you're still relatively young. Like, you know, I'm trying to do the numbers in my head here, but you must have been 18 or something like that.
18, yeah.
Yeah, it must have been a surreal kind of, both a sense of a long journey to get there, but also, you know, just a surreal kind of moment of, you know, look, on one side of me is Joel and on the other side is Masami. You know, was that a pinch yourself kind of a, I can't believe this has actually happened kind of a moment.
Oh, absolutely. How nuts is that?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I've been to a Worlds before, but there can only be one winner, of course, when you go to these events. Did I think it was going to be me going into that event? Hell no. I thought I might do okay. I thought I might make the top 10. My sights had been firmly set on the top 10 after everything that we'd done previous and races we'd been to previous.
Yeah.
But did I think that we were actually going to win it? It was only after the end of probably the first day of qualifying where I thought, this is actually going better than I thought.
Yeah.
And damn, don't mess this up. Don't make a mistake. And it wasn't just the driving, of course, it's the preparation of everything you do. And I was just like, don't make a mistake.
Yeah.
Don't get this wrong. And that's why I say thank you to the team, because we had there were two compounds for rear tire at the time, silver and gold. And I believe I was using the gold compound tire, and I went straight up to Oscar and Constant and said, this is what I want to run. This is the front tire I want to run. I'm going to need so many. And they said, well, if we give you so many, we can't give others enough to race.
Yeah.
And the others of the team said, that's absolutely fine. No problem whatsoever. Go win.
Yeah.
And as I said, it wasn't just me. It was a team effort that, yeah, very, very proud that weekend. Very, very proud. There were so many people that played a small part in that. It was pretty cool.
We don't often recognize, I think, in RC the team nature of what it takes to kind of, you know, for an individual to achieve does really take a team or a community effort. And I think you've painted that picture really beautifully.
Anybody that says they do it on their own, I don't believe them, because I don't think it's not possible. You need to have the help and support of others, just even your friends, even your friends that don't race or race at home or whatever, that you get home from a race and they give you stick about what you did or if you didn't win or something. And they mean well, they're just keeping you honest. So, all of it matters. All of it matters.
Yeah. That same year, 1994, if I have the information correct, you finished second to Masami in Pro 10 as well. I think that race might have been in Germany. Had you been doing a lot of Pro 10 racing? Was this something you were putting some time into, or really was it just a case of, look, show up at the Worlds and have a go? Was there a thriving Pro 10 scene in the UK?
That event was my first Pro 10 event. And it really was a case of, you've just done really, really well. Would you like to go?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, yeah, you know, I'm a kid. I want to go racing. So, yes, I'll go racing. It was practice was all rained away.
Yeah.
We had one day of practice. It was all going okay, but it wasn't great. And that's when I meet the Gandini brothers, GRP Tires.
Okay.
And I was doing okay, and I went up to them and I said, I can see others are using your front tire. May I have a pair? And they kindly gave me a pair, and I put it second on the grid.
Okay.
And again, as I've said to you before, you can't do it on your, well, back then you couldn't do it on your own.
Yeah.
They saw my run and came over and said, everything you want, you can have. So again, without their help, that event wouldn't have happened for Corelli and Orion and all of our team, because we needed their tires. So again, lucky. But yeah, that paid off, and we finished second at that Worlds with pretty much no practice whatsoever.
So a question I should know the answer to, but don't. That, what's the surface that you're running on at that event?
That was tarmac.
Okay. And that's something that you said you really hadn't done a whole lot of racing on tarmac.
Up until then, no.
Yeah. But really was probably the more common surface for Pro 10 racing over that kind of through the 90s.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. 1996 doesn't go so well kind of in terms of world results, but what I wanted to kind of just ask you about is, you get into this extraordinary run, really dominance is the right word, at a European championship level. You know, I think from 1995 through to about 2003 or something, you barely lose. There are some other people that win as well, but you win an extraordinary number of races in both 112 scale and, you know, a few Pro 10 and touring and all sorts of things. What was the scene like in Europe? And I guess what I'm particularly interested in is, you know, the degree to which you could rock up at a European Championship in that event, in that era, and just have an extraordinary level of confidence that if you did everything you needed to do, you know, the win was on the table for you. Is that, did it feel like that every year? I mean, it's an extraordinary run.
Yes, it did, to be honest. I'd never obviously outwardly expressed that, but I always felt that if I got this right, this was for mine to take. But again, I keep harping back to the same yeah. thing. I worked incredibly hard to make sure I was ready for those events. Racing for Corelli at the beginning was easier because obviously it's a European team. So getting help and support trackside was a lot easier, a lot more support, a lot more people. That was easier. But when the later stages of when I switched to Trinity, I knew that it was 100% on my own. So I just made sure I was always ready. The racing scene in Europe was very strong, with Oscar, Eric Jong, Marcus Mobers, Ralph Kraus, Martin Fleischbach, Jürgen. There were loads of guys that were really the Animi brothers. I mean, they were so fast and they raced so much and they tested so much. To stay in front of them was just hard work, really, really hard work. But you knew you had to do it. And if you weren't prepared to do it, I knew I wasn't going to win. So your choice was you do the work and go, or you don't do the work, don't show up. So everybody just pushed everybody. And it was just really, really good fun.
Just before we go too much further and we do get into those Trinity years, maybe, you know, can I invite you to just tell me a little bit more of the kind of Corelli story of, you know, how that company came to be, where they got started, you know, what's the kind of backstory for, you know, you were so closely associated with them over that period. What's the kind of Corelli backstory?
So Constant Paul and his father started Corelli, I believe. Jan van Kooi started a distribution called PK Model Racing. So there was a connection between the two. They had a test track in Holland, in Dordrecht. And they were just growing the business. And then, of course, when my dad became the distributor for Corelli in the UK, it was only natural that I ran for my dad. My dad obviously supported me the best he could. He gave me everything he could in the day. And then obviously when results started to come, Corelli took over and took me further, and they took me further and I took them along with me, type of thing. Maybe all the other way around, should I say. And we worked together. I worked with Constant on tyres, batteries, that type of stuff. Oscar with the motors and going to races. And it really was a team effort. So Corelli kind of started because Constant wanted to go racing and Constant wanted to be a world champion. He wanted to excel in RC, and he was very, very good. Very, very good. And then Oscar joined the company, then obviously more of us, and that's where it all started, really. It all started. So I really was there nearly from the beginning.
Yeah. And did it always have I guess I'm getting a sense of a family business kind of a feel. Was that what it was like?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, absolutely it was. Absolutely it was. I mean, when we came back from the Worlds in France, I went to the factory, you know, we had cake and coffees and teas and whatever, and it was a bit of a party. And yes, it was very, very family orientated. There was four or five people that worked there. So you were one of them. You were one of them. So yes, it did. It mattered to all of us. It mattered to all of us. And that's why I say I didn't do it on my own. There was a team behind us and everybody played their part.
Yeah. The other thing I think it's, you know, just worth being clear about is that the company did not just build the cars either, didn't they? It was motors and batteries and tires and all, you know, it was a company that were trying to kind of cover the whole kind of scene as much as possible.
Oh yeah.
Not every manufacturer took that approach.
No, they didn't, but they wanted to be a master of all. They wanted to do everything in-house. So All the tread and glue tires were all done in-house. It was all done there. All the motor winding was done in-house. All the oven baking was done in-house. Everything that could be done there was done there. So the quality was very, very high. Very, very high, because it was basically all handmade. As you rightly say, I think they're one of the only companies that truly took on every aspect of racing at that time.
Yeah, impressive organization. Kudos to them. When and how then did, you know, with all of that kind of history and the great relationships there in the background, when and how did the sort of shift to kind of move over to Trinity happen for you? Where does that sort of fit into things?
For me, it was kind of wanting to race in America more.
Yeah.
To do more in America, to race bigger events, to race against Joel Johnson more, to race against the Reedy Associated team more, to go and just put myself out there all the time against the best all the time was my drive, to be honest. No other reason than that. Just another opportunity that Ernie Pivetti gave me that I just grabbed with both hands and went for it.
So tell me a little bit about the difference, if there was, or the different feeling in that team or that organization compared with the experience you'd had at Corelli. How were Trinity to kind of work with?
Good question, really. We've mentioned that the Corelli and my racing at the beginning was a very much a family orientated effort. I'm not saying that Trinity or racing in America was bad at all. There was very much a sense of I must win before you. You must beat your teammate.
Okay.
That's when I learned very, very, very quickly that everybody wanted to win for themselves.
Okay.
That didn't change my approach.
Yeah.
Didn't change anything for me. It did make me potentially a little bit more guarded. But I just made sure I was talking and working with the right people. So then it was Jim Dieter.
Yep.
Motors, batteries with Jim, Mike Woods that worked in the factory with the chassis and stuff. Kirby Hand, TRC tires, just making sure that I was always around and helping them to help me be better for us.
It's
a little bit different.
A little bit different. Yeah, I'm just going to say that's some extraordinary names that you've just kind of rolled off there, isn't it? Someone like Jim Dieter, such an incredible engineer and kind of figure in the sport in that era. I think Jim had his hands on some of the chassis design as well. If I remember rightly.
Yeah, with Jim, great guy. Love him to bits. He's done a lot for me. He made sure I was in the right place, had the right stuff at the right time to get some results for him and me. Jim's kind of got a little bit the same attitude as me, really. If you're going to put 100% in, I'm going to put 100% in, and I'm going to match what you can do.
Yeah.
If you don't want to put any time and effort in, I'm not going to waste my time with you. That's his attitude to racers. So the amount of times we would be at a track practicing, it's 3, 4, 5, 6. When are you going to give up, Jim? I'm not giving up. You give up. I'm not giving up. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. One more. We'll do one more and go home. That was our attitude. There'd be Josh Cyril would be with us, or Joel would be there.
Yeah.
But the harder you work for Jim, the harder he works for you. That was always what you got back from Jim.
And paying attention to and noticing that, which we talked about earlier, probably the key to, you know, for you to understand that that's how the relationship would be. David, all of that brings us to the 1998 Worlds kind of campaign. There are two IFMA World Championships on offer in 12th and Pro 10, and the World Cup for Touring Car, the formal prelude to IFMA declaring a class an official World Championship category. It happens in the UK. It is, you know, nobody that's listening to this doesn't know that, you know, you didn't sweep the whole lot and win all three of those Worlds events. Give me a kind of a tour through that event, your preparation, what the event itself was like. You know, how did that extraordinary kind of series of three World Championship wins in a short space of time, how did that happen?
12 scale was the start of the event. That kind of started for me probably 2 or 3 months before when we started to prepare for that, because obviously the Americans wanted to know what tires to use, what do we need to do for this, that, and the other, motors, batteries type of stuff. That's when the work really, really started. Of course, you've got your baselines everywhere. But that's when they started asking me a lot of questions to get ready for that event, to make sure they had enough for everybody. And 12 scale was kind of just me going through my routine of racing, if I'm honest, for that event. Josh Cyril gave me a great run for my money in that event. It could have gone either way. Yep. He made a small mistake, which cost him. But that's one of the finals of racing in my career that I will never forget. Because halfway through one of the last final, when it was over, I'd won. I had 4 minutes to enjoy racing around in a World's A final with no pressure whatsoever, knowing that I'd won it.
That's probably a really rare experience, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, Josh unfortunately made a mistake, which took him out of the race completely. And when that happened, it was over.
Yeah.
And I remember going down the main straight and turning and going, just enjoy this, because this might never happen again.
Yeah.
You can go as fast as you like or as slow as you like. You can do whatever you like in a World A final with these guys stood next to you, and it doesn't make any difference. You've just won.
Yeah.
And I remember that, and I went, wow, this is cool. This is really, really cool. So that was pretty impressive for myself, to be honest.
Yeah.
Pro 10 for me on carpet is not something we ever raced in the UK.
Yeah.
I did a couple of club meetings before, and literally only one or two meetings before, and was really, really struggling. Really, really struggling. And Josh came over and offered me a hand and helped me set my car up, and then TQ and the win came my way. So I was very, very fortunate, very, very appreciative of Josh helping me out in Pro 10. We would have been okay to make top 10 on my own, but without his help, there's no way I would have won the Pro 10 class. And then the touring car was Losi back in the day.
Yeah.
And Gil Losi Jr. and Ron Rossetti were there to help the team. They sent two guys over, came to help us prep stuff, tires, all that type of thing. And we all had our own touring cars, and Junior was absolutely, completely insistent that I ran his car.
Okay.
And he wouldn't even let me put my car on the track. He was insistent I ran his car his way. And yeah, the result speaks for itself. I think we locked out the top 5 spots, I think, for Losi that weekend as a team. It was round by round heads up racing. I think 4 or 5 of us had perfect scores.
Okay.
And that was credit again to the teamwork and effort of Gil Losi, Ron Rossetti, and the Losi team. So yeah, that was fantastic, to be honest. That was just, everything was just coming together, and we had the right stuff at the right time.
And just as simple as that, another 3 world championships kind of go up on the board. Tell me a little bit about touring car racing, because that's really pretty early on in, there had been some touring car racing around a little bit a couple of years before that. But what was that kind of emergence of touring car like, and how did you find the transition or find it as a category to drive compared with the pan car classes that you had been more used to? What was touring car like?
It was the growth was rapid.
It was extraordinary.
It felt like you'd figure your car out and you think you're onto a winning base, and you go to the next meeting and everything had moved on. It was kind of the triangle way of engineering, as I call it. You know, you're working to get toward the point of where your competitors were, but they've already gone to the next direction. They're already off on a new tangent, improving other things. And I always felt that we were always behind. I never, ever felt in touring car that I could ever get on a even playing field. I couldn't ever even it for myself. I always felt like I was behind in some way or another. And that's when it became apparent to me very quickly that there was so much testing and development that was going on. Yes, I did touring car. Yes, I did give it a fair amount of my time. Yes, I did give it a chunk of effort. Of course I did. But I was very aware that my bread and butter, what I was good at, was the foam pan car racing stuff.
Yeah.
I never shied away from any touring car event. I went to all of the world championships, good or bad. Went to Reedy races, good or bad. Went to all of those events. Did well in UK. Did, won a couple of Euros. Never shied away. But I always felt that I was never quite as good as the rubber tire racing as I was on the foam racing. Simply, I think, because I just couldn't put the amount of time and effort in living in the UK with the weather we had compared to compared to what the guys in America and the rest of the world could do. But yeah, the development of touring car was huge. I mean, the 98 we spoke about, every manufacturer was there with a team. Everybody was there running. There was 130 people, maybe 140. It was full. And every single team was there. That's probably the biggest touring car race there ever has been. So yeah. And then from then on, it was just, the development was just crazy. Absolutely crazy. For me personally, too difficult to keep up with.
Yeah. Did you get involved in, you know, on that chassis development side in the kind of the Losi projects? They started with the Street Weapon, went on to, I think it was the Triple XS and the JRXS were some of the other chassis they released over the following kind of period. Did you get involved in testing and development of those cars with the team?
We all gave our ideas. Of course, we would always give our honest feedback of what was going on and what we felt was right. But all of the end decisions were always Gil Losi Jr.'s decisions and choices.
Yeah.
It would always be the way he wanted to go. He was always open to our criticisms. He would listen and he would adjust and change certain things if he thought it was required. But at the end of the day, they were all his cars that we raced.
They did have quite a unique is the word I'm looking for, flavor or of design and engineering around the Losi touring cars, didn't they? And certainly for a period were quite competitive in a sense, maybe in a sense, you know, the design development and direction left them behind a little bit, but there was always a unique character to the Losi cars over that period.
Yes. Street Weapon, we'll have three belts, and Triple XS, we'll have just the one. Now we're going to go back to having a JRXS. We're going to have two. We're going to put the battery down the middle, though.
Yeah.
So we're going to give you really, really big diffs and really, really short little suspension arms. Junior, his imagination, his creativity, it was second to none. Absolutely second to none. Amazing guy for that. But probably also that was his problem because he could never end anything. He could never draw a line under anything because he was always trying something new, trying something different. He would never copy.
Yeah.
He was never interested at looking at other people's stuff. He always wanted to be unique. He brought out the double joint front drive shafts for touring car. We had them at the Kissimmee Wells. He was the first person to make them. He was always pushing what he felt. But yes, unique is a word I would use. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about a couple more of the world championships over that year. I think you were in South Africa, you know, that famous touring car worlds won by Surikhan with that extraordinary start, but also finishing second to Masami in 112 scale. What was it like to go and travel to South Africa to race at a worlds?
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That was a pretty cool place, to be honest. Some things did go wrong with us, with the locals, unfortunately, but that can happen. But the racing itself was really, really good fun. I never really got to grips with beating Masami or being competitive against him on asphalt with 12 scale. Again, it's just something we don't do in the UK. So my ability to practice was pretty much zero. So it really was, we were always on the back foot going into those events on asphalt. And he always had the upper hand. Carpet kind of evened it out, but on the asphalt, just couldn't do it. Surikhan's move at the start, yeah, that was pretty cool. He took off like a rocket. We made the final that year, but we weren't in the game to challenge, unfortunately. But yeah, no, I love the place. Great people that were running it. Yeah, really, really enjoyed that event.
One more world championship win awaits you that I just wanted to ask about. 2006, you're in Italy, and it's, you know, back in the favoured kind of 12 scale class. I guess one of the things I wonder about that event for you, and without knowing the kind of inside story of it, you know, it comes 8 years after that triple win in 1998, and I can't help, you know, but wondering whether was it starting to feel like there might not be another one, or was it just a matter of, you know, getting it on a surface that worked for you, and, you know, you were always kind of going to be there. You just spoke about the challenge of racing Masami on bitumen on tarmac. So tell me a little bit about Italy. You know, what was it like to kind of to stand again on the top step of the podium at a world championship?
The kind of sign off was kind of how I felt.
Okay.
After that weekend, kind of realized at that moment, you ain't going to do that again. You've been quite lucky there. You're not going to do that again. You need to hang that radio up pretty damn quick. We were racing for Corelli then as well.
Okay.
And we'd gone to Euros, I believe, in Tenerife, I think, maybe.
Yeah.
Somewhere down there. And they'd given me their latest car, which was not very clever. And then we went to a club race a couple of weeks after that with the same car and struggling to just complete 8-minute runs. Mm. And I said to the guys, I said, look, I can't turn up in 2 or 3 weeks with this car. I can't do it. So I turned up with a Corelli car, Corelli rear end, Corelli chassis, everything Corelli. And I had put an associated L4 front end on it. And that's the car I ran at that event. Coming to the end of my time racing then, really, at that level. So my best friend, Darren, and a guy called Stu, they came with me from the UK. They just came for a laugh, really.
Yeah.
And to help a little bit. I don't know what they did to help, but they were there.
Laughed.
And we just had a good time, really. We just had a good laugh. My preparation was decent. I knew it was good enough, and it did come good in the end, but I had quite a few struggles along the way. Shout out to Frank Calandra, who helped me a little bit at that event with some tyres. And when I crossed the line at the end, and a few guys were running brushless systems, I honestly felt, I said, that's probably me done.
At that level, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've kind of exceeded your expectation here this weekend, and that's you done. Young family was at home by then.
Yep, yep.
So I kind of thought, yeah, you've...
Life's kind of moved on.
Yeah, that's a nice way to end it, really.
Yeah. I think, you know, I wanted to ask you about this because 2006 really is a real turning point in the electric side of our sport. The LiPo batteries, the emergence of brushless motor and a speed control technology, you know, really kind of 2006 really was around the era when, or around the period when that happened.
Yes.
How much of those things, you've spoken a little bit already about how different it was prior to that, but how much of those two, you know, battery and motor technology in particular, changed electric racing?
That was absolutely huge. You could see already the LRP were there, and they had their Sphere, I think it was.
Yeah.
And they had their brushless stuff in John Orr's car. And John Orr was the one that gave me a run for my money at the end of that event.
Yeah.
And it was clear to see watching them that runtime wasn't their issue. Runtime they had plenty to spare. They could have, if it was a 9-minute race, they would have probably been okay. But their issue was they couldn't get the power out of the system.
Yeah.
So watching that behind me, I realized immediately that brush was done.
Yeah.
Because that development opportunity right there is huge. I remember saying to Oscar, because we had the V-brush stuff.
Yeah.
And I said to him, you need to stop this right now, and that's where you need to go. We had a bit of a discussion about it, and he was unsure, but I was like, it has to be. That has to be the way it goes. And that's led us down this path that we're going down now, where it's all just too fast. too much power and too fast, which is a nice problem to have, but so difficult for the majority to drive.
I watched an interview with you at the Worlds in 2006, at Touring Car Worlds. I think it might have been RC Racing TV, one of those kind of, you know, they interview people. And there was an interview with you in which they asked you about the speed of touring cars at that time. And touring cars at that time, for those of us who are around, we were destroying motors, throwing wines. You know, motors were one-run kind of things. And you said in that interview, you know, that things were kind of at their limit and you didn't think there was much more speed to come. You know, in hindsight, we now kind of look back on that and go, you know, the cars are so much faster now than they were in 2006, you know, and the motor power is, I mean, not quite unlimited, but almost in a sense, you know, there's so much power available. And I guess I'm curious with that background of kind of, you know, by 2006 feeling like things were at their limit, knowing how much faster we are now in on-road, and particularly, I guess I'm talking touring car, but it's probably true in 12 scale as well. Are we at a healthy place in terms of on-road racing, in terms of horsepower and speed and the way that technology has evolved? You know, it's a simple question to ask, not a simple question to answer, but, you know, what's your feeling? Yeah.
So if we look at it from the racer's perspective, it's probably a good thing because he can buy too much power. Mm. He can just put it in the car and he can drive it and there's too much power. Does that make for good racing? No, I don't think it does. Mm. I don't think it does make for good racing. Then you have the spec scenario where you go, okay, well, let's race 13.5, 17.5, 21.5, whatever you wish. Brushless motors are so close that then does generate very, very, very close racing.
Mm.
So that is better, isn't it?
Does that then create
the fight to find other stuff that's better? Mm. Or does that promote bad driving standards because people take bigger risks?
Mm. Mm.
For me, what brushless and LiPo has definitely done, it's turn every single race into a sprint because you're flat out from the beginning to the end.
Mm.
You don't back off. You're full go.
Yeah.
So yes, it is a race, but it's a sprint race.
Mm.
The racecraft is simply get past the guy in front and go.
Hmm.
There's no other thought process to your 8 minutes or your 5 minute run.
Hmm.
So is that a good thing? It's different. Do I enjoy that? Do I enjoy that as much? No, I don't.
Hmm.
I don't enjoy that as much. So where do we go? I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know what the answer is. I don't think the racing community would necessarily take a step back to having stuff that wouldn't run time and you have to make it run time or change your driving style. So no, I don't really know the answer to that. Mm. Commercially, it's also not been fantastic for the industry because everything lasts so long.
Yeah. reliability is a double-edged sword, isn't it? Yeah.
You can say that it's great for the racer and racing is expensive. You've just said when we were using brush stuff, with brush motors back when we finished, we were literally tying the brushes to the motor. So when they desoldered, they'd still keep connection.
That's right. Yeah. It was not in a good state. No,
it wasn't. No. So it's five pounds for a brush and you're cutting the comb, you're zapping the magnet, you're buying batteries every other week. And did anybody ever moan about the cost of racing? I don't remember people moaning about it because it was part of going racing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very, very different. Do I know the answer? No, I don't. Do I like the direction it's gone in? I think watching the top guys race at any level is amazing.
Mm.
Watching Reinhard wheel a touring car against Volker and those guys and Bruno, that's pretty damn impressive.
Mm.
Watching the top guys at the Worlds when they came to the UK, yeah, that was pretty cool. That was pretty cool.
Mm.
But to club race that's very, very difficult.
Yeah, and certainly, you know, touring car, I think, you know, I guess what I'm seeing around the world is that in terms of club racing, modified class touring car is pretty not in a healthy way. The numbers are not there.
No.
People just can't do it.
Nope.
for a range of reasons, and the speed and accessibility is probably one of the primary ones. But as you say, the challenge of, you know, where to, is it a case of limiting horsepower? Is it a case of taking away traction from the car so that horsepower becomes, you know, you know, do we run a 25% narrower tire so that, you know, traction is even more limited, and so then horsepower becomes less relevant? I don't know. Is it an area? Also, there's all sorts of possibilities in there, but finding the right answer, yeah, and being prepared to take the risk of doing it.
We need to find an answer that opens up the window of opportunity.
Mm.
So we need to find the answer that allows you to solve the puzzle in multiple ways to try and gain an advantage. How we do that, I don't know. Whether it's reducing battery power, so you limit how much battery power you have available, or is it time to start running smaller motors? Physical size.
Yes.
So you reduce the power, just physically reduce the power, and you physically run a smaller motor in the car. Should we be running LiFe batteries, lower voltage? Should we... If you change just to LiFe into smaller motors, you've immediately made things slower, and then you're back on a development curve. Should we just do it to see where we end up? I don't know if we should or shouldn't. But to get modified back into being the most popular class, we have to change something.
Yeah.
But it still must be the fastest class of everything that's raced in that category. It yes. still must be the pinnacle. That's the yes. thing. We can't dumb it to the point where it's just like running a 13.5. There's no point. It still must be a challenge, and it must be an open challenge for you to go and solve.
I think it was when I spoke with, I think it was Joel Johnson, who had heard on the show a little while ago, and we had a conversation about this. I think it was Joel, and we talked a little bit about, you know, with touring car in particular, but I think the same is true for 12 scale. The actual chassis constraints, rules, size, and kind of, you know, construction format have been so stable for so long that there's no longer huge amounts of innovation on the chassis side either. And, you know, we were just spitballing the same as you and I are, and, you know, wondered about, you know, whether a significant change in the chassis design size constraints, you know, a slightly bigger or slightly smaller, or some different rules around chassis design might also kickstart a, you know, a kind of a re-energizing, if you like, because of the freedom that opens up. And, you know, so then I start thinking about Formula One and, you know, the way in that full scale, the real F1, you know, the way a rules reset every kind of half a dozen years or so in that category kickstarts a whole new kind of level of interest and development and innovation. And, you know, so I guess I wonder about, you know, in on-road in particular, you know, whether we're a little bit stale on the design side, and whether a change in some format that really does open things up for the car manufacturers as well as on the electronic side might be an interesting thing to play around with.
Yeah, I love that analogy of in 2 years' time, we reset the rules. Give everybody time to go and figure it out.
Yeah.
Time to produce the product, time to go and source what they need to source and do something. But yeah, I agree with that completely. What's right or wrong at the moment, I don't know the answer to.
Yeah, yeah. Let's just talk a little bit more about 12 scale. I think you've just been involved in the European 12 scale championships that took place in the UK a couple of months back. Alexander Hagberg adding to his winning tally in modified and Orlowski in stock. Tell me a little bit about that event. What was your involvement like? And how rewarding do you find it being on that sort of organizational side of things?
So that came... That came around because I was in a BRCA committee meeting with the 12 scale section, and they, Jim Spencer, our FA rep, basically said that nobody had put forward for the Euros. And I was like, huh, we'll do it. Excuse me, what, pardon? We'll have a go. Do you want to ask your club members first? No, it'll be all right. And then I kind of dropped the bomb on them. And my best mate, Darren, that runs the Eastbourne Club, was kind of like, yeah, yeah, I want to put my stamp on a Euros. Yeah, I'm up for that.
Okay.
A good friend of mine, Stu. Same two guys that came to me with me in Italy, funny enough. He's the chairman of the club, and he was like, "Yeah, let's do it. Let's let's make it bigger and better. Let's put on a show." Mm. And those two guys were really good, really, really good. It's a lot of work, and the way I view it, I didn't get any complaints. You don't do it for gratitude. You don't do it for anybody coming up and saying thank you. You don't do it for those reasons. You do it to give back to the hobby. And I said to Darren, did anybody complain? No, no complaints. Yeah. Well, then we did a good job.
Yeah.
Then we did a good job. We put on a show. Everybody's gone away happy. We've had some great racing. We've got two great champions. We did everything we possibly could have done. I don't think we would have changed anything when we ran the event. There's nothing we could have done better, I don't feel.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I was pleased to give something back. After helping with the Worlds in England a couple of years before and then doing this, I've now done my bit. I feel like I've given something back. I've supported the BRCA and I've given something back to 12-scale racing. I've been a part of those two events and played quite a role in it. So, I feel it was good. I enjoy doing it. As I said, I enjoy giving something back to the sport.
And so tell me a little bit about, you know, we're in a world's year for 12 scale. We're coming up later in the year in the US. With that event just recently in mind and people like Hagberg and Olowski kind of going head to head, I think Reinhard was there as well and a bunch of others.
Yep.
You know, what's your assessment of the state of competitive play and, you know, what do you think we might see at that Worlds later in the year?
I think it'll be a complete shake-up when you go to America. Mm. Black carpet in America is completely different to anything else you race on anywhere else in the world. A lot of the locals are going to be seriously quick because they'll be racing on that carpet from now until then.
Mm.
Kemp Anderson, Sam Isaacs, Donnie Leah, they're going to be there. Well, not there, but they'll be on that carpet practicing their hearts out to get that world title. So I think it's going to be mad, to be honest. I think it's going to be incredibly competitive. I think it's going to be incredibly quick because the grip is so high on those types. We see when we watch the Snowbirds or Cleveland or any of those races in America, they're stupidly fast. Mm. I think it's going to be pretty cool, to be honest. I just hope they lay a really good technical track so we can see them all go racing. I hope it's not a three-lane motorway flat-outs thing. I hope they actually get to drive and race. It'll be good.
I'm getting the sense from you that, you know, there's a genuine chance of a first time world champion at this event.
I hope so. Yeah. That's why I'm a bit excited because I don't think Alex, you never ever say Alex isn't gonna do well. You'll never say that Olowski or Reinhard are never gonna of course you don't.
Yeah.
Those guys turn up to events and bind their radio to somebody else's car and then walk away with the trophy. They're that good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just being in America, being very, very different, I think the Americans have got the upper hand going into that event. Reinhard did win the Snowbirds on that carpet. He did.
Yeah.
It's a control tire this time. So again, control tire racing means one thing.
Mm.
That's more practice because you've got to get the best out of that tire. Will he have the opportunity to do that before he gets there? I don't know.
Mm.
So therefore, the locals are going to have an advantage for sure.
It does feel to me like, you know, after a let's say a lean period internationally for American on the on-road side, there is, and you just named some of the guys that they're starting to feel to me like there's a bit of a reemergence going on, and you know, we might see some internationally competitive US drivers over the next couple of years, and it might start as soon as this November at this Worlds. Yeah, interesting time.
Yeah, could do. Yeah.
David, let's just kind of whip quickly through a couple of other things. I'm conscious of the time, but you have done a little bit of racing in some other categories as well. You've done some eighth on-road racing, including winning some British national races in that category. Tell me a little bit about that. What have you enjoyed about running eight scale? You know, how and where did that come about?
That came about because Trinity was sold in Japan by Kyosho.
Okay.
And Kyosho wanted some drivers to run their car, their Phantom 8-scale car around the world.
Yep.
So we were all given kits and stuff to go and enjoy a bit of nitro racing. baptism of fire for me, having never fired one of those things up. But really, again, I enjoy it. So I enjoy that stuff so much because, again, that's back to the team effort. You need a pit man. You need a pit man. You need a guy that knows about the engines. You need a guy that's mixing your fuel for you. You need a guy that does tires. You need all these people to put pieces of the puzzle together for you to even stand a chance of competing. So he really enjoyed that. I've never done particularly well with 8 scale. Made a couple of European A finals, never made a world A final, just missed out when I was in America. But really, really enjoyed it. Working with Josh whenever I've been to America to race, he loves his nitro and he's so good at it. But again, he can't necessarily dedicate, he couldn't dedicate the amount of time he needed to, but he was very, he TQ'd a worlds and stuff. He was very, very good. Very, very good. Made a world's A final with the little nitro car, the 10 scale stuff, and won a Euros with the little nitro car for Kyosho. And really enjoyed it. Really, really enjoyed that. Really enjoyed the on-road stuff. It was really, really good fun.
Did you, you know, having come from an electric background, how challenging was it to get to grips with the long category finals, the long, you know, 30, 45, 60 minute sort of finals? Was that fun? Was it difficult?
Yeah, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I was always shocked, no matter what race it was, whether it was an English national or the 45 minutes when I won the Euros in England at Halifax, that it was, oh, it's over. What happened there then? Is that is it we done? That's it. Really? To the point where in some races when you're behind and you're not catching up, it was always felt like they were over really, really quickly. When the stuff was working well, should I say, when I was racing and it was going well, it was always over too quick. When it was a hurtful, painful, this isn't going too well and I can hear the rear belts about to go and I'm going to, that was agony. But when they were good races, it was, just gone in a flash. So no, I never really struggled with the race duration, to be honest. I enjoyed it.
Whereas I do recall the first time I ran a 60-minute National A final being barely able to walk by the end of it.
That's something I always used to do. Every pit stop, I'd change the leg I was standing on. Yes,
that's right.
I'd always cross my legs and change the leg I was standing on every pit stop. So you'd always, your radio, you'd always go, so if you're going clockwise or whatever it was, it'd always be one click right, change your leg, one click right, change your leg. And then by the time you've done that, the dude's put the fuel in it and off you go.
That's right. It's not too much an opportunity. You did a little bit of off-road as well. I think, again, I saw an interview with you. It might have been at a Neo buggy race that you were, you know, and the sense in the interview was that it was just a fun experience. But off-road really just didn't ever quite capture your imagination. You know, but you dabbled a little bit. Is that right?
Yeah. So when we were Trinity Losi, they wanted me to do some off-road. TQ'd English National, never won one, but I did manage to TQ, I made some A-finals. Rallycross, made A-finals and stuff. Made a Euro A-final, but never did very well in the finals, to be honest. And, of course, the Nitro stuff was because I was working for Horizon Hobby as the TLR brand manager in Europe. So that kind of came hand in hand with that, really. The electric stuff, the off-road, when I was racing for Trinity, back when I was being competitive in 12 scale, that was the only time me and my dad really had a disagreement. And he was right and I was wrong because I was a kid. He said to me one day, he said, "You're becoming a jack of all and a master of none."
Oh, interesting.
You won't be remembered for that.
Wow.
And it was because I was doing off-road. New group of friends, we're going off-road racing, we're doing this, that, and the other. So instead of being practicing the on-road stuff, I was racing off-road, doing okay, making A-finals, going club racing, having fun, enjoying myself, then going to a national and going, this is a bit more difficult than it used to be. I didn't do too well that run. That wasn't good. Grind out a result and go home, and then wasn't fixing it. I was going back to my off-road stuff. And my dad just said, just be careful and I wasted a couple of years, probably 18 months. And then thought, no, he's right. I can't carry on like this. One's got to go. So I stopped the off-road instantly, put all the stuff out, gave it all back, and then just concentrated on road from then on.
It does that does put in, I guess, in perspective, the achievements of someone like Masami, I guess I'm thinking of, you know, in that era, who won so many world championships in so many different categories. And, you know, and even today, someone like, you know, we've already used the name of Michael Olowski or Bruno Coelho, people like that, who somehow managed to compete across multiple categories. I guess there's an incredible dependence on the people around them and the, you know, the support of the team. And we've talked about that.
Yeah.
But it does put in perspective that extraordinary ability of some of those people to run in multiple categories.
Yeah, it does. And run up it does. And they're also in the right, they were in the right place. Take Masami, for example. Yeah. He was always in the right place for Yokomo to send him to the next world's track for a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And let him drive around for a month.
Yeah.
That's a lovely opportunity to have incredible talent.
Yes.
Can drive anyway. And he had all this ability to test and practice.
Yeah.
Again, UK, we have permanent off-road tracks. Yes, we do. But they weren't something which were open necessarily 7 days a week for you to go and practice and play at.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my dad just warned me, don't become a jack of all, master of none.
Yeah.
You know, your opportunities aren't there. Your opportunities are in the on-road racing, so you need to stick to what you know.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about on the racetrack side of things, and I do want to just ask you about the industry side in a minute, but I saw a reference to a couple of, you know, interviews and articles where you worked as an engineer or a pit crew at some off-road races. I think maybe Dakota Fend at the 2012 Worlds, if I read a story right, and Darren Bloomfield at some Euros. Firstly, have I read that right? But secondly, what's that experience been like of kind of being there as a on the other side of the team relationship that you've spoken so much about? You know, what's that experience been like?
It's terrifying. I hate it. Because you're in complete control of these kids' destiny. See, so I went to Argentina and pitted for Dakota Fend.
Yeah.
And you're on a world stage. You've got a lap time of, I don't know what it was, 48 seconds or something.
Yeah.
So if you call him in a lap wrong, he runs out of fuel and you look an idiot.
Yeah.
And his race, and it, you know, all of that money, expense, time and effort to get him there has been completely and utterly wasted. So it's terrifying. You're building the car for the kid. You're helping him. You're cleaning it. You're stripping it down. You're rebuilding it. You take the engine out. Do you do this? Do you do that? You're just paranoid it's going to fall apart because you're responsible. When it's your own stuff, you don't. You care less. But if it fails, you go, you idiot, that's your fault.
Yeah.
But when you're doing it for somebody else, and it's the same for Darren.
Hmm.
I did let Darren down at one of the Euros. It was my fault. He knows it was my fault. I apologized. It was my fault. And I felt terrible because he should have been top three, top four. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously he wasn't, so he didn't, but the opportunity, I took it away from him and that was my fault.
Yeah.
And you feel bad and you can't ever put that right. I don't like it. I will do it now for people in England at nationals and stuff. If they ask me to come and help, I will do it. But did I enjoy doing it back then when it was important? No.
Interesting. Yeah. Is there, what's the sense for you like of working? I mean, I guess you've spoken there about the responsibility and the duties side of it. I'm interested in what you might have experienced as, you know, passing on in a sense some wisdom or experience or stuff around the mindset or, you know, helping young, you know, Dakota Fend would have been quite young at that Worlds. Darren, you know, would have been quite young when you were working with him. Did you have a sense of being able to pass on some of your own experience or mindset or approach or, you know, sort of that almost coaching rather than preparing the car kind of side of it? Was that something that you were conscious of?
Yeah. Yeah. With Darren especially. Still friends with Darren, still talk to him every now and again. I found him frustrating because I could see the immense talent that he had. But his car prep just let him down. And trying to get him engaged Monday to Friday to give himself the opportunity, and he would let himself down. But raw talent for racing, I wish I had half of what he had. And I you can't You can't shout and scream. You can't jump up and down. You can't kick off. You can only keep saying, dude, you should have really done that in the week.
Yeah.
You should have really taken care of that. That really shouldn't be like that, should it? Mm. And with Darren, at moments, there was a moment early on in the championship at Clanfield, and I still remember it, where him and his dad had an argument before the start of a race. And he'd won a few nationals before that, and he won a few nationals after that, and he lost the championship by 1 point because of that moment of a championship. And I said, was it really worth the argument? Because you've now lost the championship because of that moment. Mm. Don't ever do that to yourself again. Mm. Have the argument after the race, not before. And then he went on to win a couple of national championships because he put the pieces of the puzzle together himself. So that was... Yeah. That was quite good to see him progress. Mm. Dakota was just one race. Mm. It was only that one race in Argentina. He, I can see from the results, and I do watch because I met his parents were there as well.
Yeah.
I just did my best to give him the best opportunity to be the best he could be that weekend. Mm. And we were the only TLR in the final that weekend. Mm. So I felt like we achieved. He felt like we achieved. Hmm. That's all I could do for him that weekend.
Surely you take responsibility for all of the achievements in his career, right? You've coached him and prepared him and set him on the path.
I'm sure he doesn't even remember my name.
No, when he wins the 10 Scale Worlds later this year, you should say I helped create that.
That was all me. I'll take credit for that.
Let's talk a little bit away from the racetrack, just some of the things you've been involved in. On the industry side, you've been working with the Zen Racing Project for a little while now. Tell me a little bit about that. What's the story there?
Yeah, so I was working at Horizon Hobby UK, but Horizon were going to close the unit. So I moved back to my hometown. And a couple of good friends wanted to start up an RC car business. So we started Zen Racing, which helped me move home, use some of my contacts to pick up a few brands, and we've been rolling for the last 10 years.
Okay.
Primarily 12-scale touring car and 8-scale on-road. So all the stuff that I know and do and know where to acquire bits and pieces, and that's what we've been doing.
It's been enjoyable?
Highs and lows, like everything in life. Highs and lows. Of course, I kind of lost my hobby years ago because it was obviously my work, but now I've truly lost my hobby.
Yeah.
Because even if I go to my local club on a Wednesday night, everybody sees me as, oh, there's the guy from Zen Racing. They don't see David, they see the guy from Zen Racing. And if their speedos stop working, that's my problem.
Yeah.
If something's gone wrong, that's my problem and I have to fix it. And you do, because it's your job, so you've lost your hobby.
Yeah.
And I find that aspect of it quite difficult, quite tiring, but it is what it is.
It is what it is.
But no, it's been good. It's been good. I'm very grateful for the guys that have helped us keep it going. We've got some new and exciting things on the horizon, which will be very, very cool. We carry on.
You don't want to give us a world exclusive announcement right now about something new coming for?
Yeah, you'll probably find out in the next 24, 48 hours.
Oh, fantastic. Well, maybe even before this episode comes out, there'll be an announcement there.
Yes.
Just give me a little bit of an insight into the kind of brands that you're working with and representing. So, you know, who is Zen Racing kind of in terms of, you know, what you're working with?
So we work closely with Maxima from Roche and Destiny.
Yep.
So we have a Destiny 12 scale car that's pretty much our own design. Help with from Teru for all the plastic parts. So there's kind of a group of three of us that all work together.
Yep.
So that's Roche, Destiny, Radtech, Xenon, all working together. Then we've got Shepherd for our Nitro stuff and ARC, Blitz body shells and stuff. All coming from ARC from Jones.
Hmm.
Still the Trinity agent. Ernie's obviously left us now, which is great shame, great shock. And that made me sit back for a little bit and think about things. But we're still the Trinity agent, and working with the Kevin and the guys there, EA batteries, LiPo and stuff. So we've got a pretty good array of a lot of stuff, to be honest.
Good set of gear.
Yeah, the motto of the shop is I'd race with what I sell.
Yeah.
People know if they buy it off my store, then it's pretty much the stuff that I would go racing with if I wanted to go racing. That's pretty much the way we work.
And you still are doing a little bit of racing, doing a little bit of club racing, or I think I read somewhere you might have even, you know, been 13.5 national champ last year, if I read that rightly. Is that you're still doing some racing yourself?
Yeah, so I've been the 13.5 stock national championship for the last, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 years in the UK.
Okay.
I did the first national, I did the first day of the first national this year and decided enough was enough. So I did that. I did that day. We TQ'd and won that day.
Yeah.
And the enjoyment was gone. And I got back to my pits and I started going through the motions of preparing the car for Sunday, just cleaning it, tidying it, setting your pits up, sorting out your tires, getting the next 6 sets ready, getting everything ready. And I looked, I put my tools down. I looked at my friend that I race with, Gav, and I just looked at him and went, before I said a word, he said, "You're done, aren't you?" I'm done. I'm done. I need a break.
Yeah.
So I've done some club racing this year.
Yeah.
Enjoyed that. Had a bit of a laugh, which has been good fun. It's the hobby aspect. I want to go racing now when I want to go, and I want to enjoy what I'm doing. I don't want to have to be there and have to race and have to perform. I don't want that pressure, and I don't want that. Want that anymore, so I will race now for fun.
I didn't know that story, and so when I asked that question, I didn't know that, you know, kind of was where you were at. I'm curious, you know, that's obviously a little while ago. Have you had any kind of it's a funny hobby, isn't it, that it almost feels like you can't let, and I've left several times but I keep coming back. And you know, have you had any moments since then when you've gone, oh, maybe I'm not done, maybe I'll be a bit tempted to, you know, where you're really kind of saying, actually, in terms of that serious racing, I am done.
I'm pretty sure I am done. As I said, I've done some club racing locally with my friends.
Yeah.
I had an opportunity to race a slightly bigger event the other week and I decided I wasn't going to. I didn't want to. That's just how I feel right now. If in the future I want to do it, I mean, the thing is as well, the car development of the Destiny brand falls on my plate. It's my job. So there will be times when I need to go and run and learn and do change. We're not making any changes to the car for next year. If they are, they'll be incredibly minor. There won't be a kit change. So I have got a little bit of breathing space that I don't have to do the work now. So for now, I'm quite happy not committing to do anything. We'll see. I'm under no pressure to do it or not to do it.
Yeah. Fair. Second last question then.
Yes.
You know, just reflecting on that kind of development work, you know, how rewarding is that sort of engineering design development sort of side, you know, now today, the work you're doing through Destiny, is it pretty cool to see something that you've worked on out on a racetrack and winning races in the hands of drivers around the place?
Oh, yeah. When you've sold something to someone that's been struggling, or you've sold something to someone and then you see a Facebook page, there can only be one winner on a day.
Yeah.
There can only be one winner. And normally that's the same person in the same country or in the same area, because they dominate and they win. So those type of posts don't really interest me. It's the posts you get from people where they go, I had a great day's racing. It was wicked. Yeah. I put the car down, had a fun day racing with my friends. Oh, by the way, I finished here and did this, but I had a great day's racing.
Yeah.
And if they're using your product and they say that, that's a win.
Yeah.
That to me means all the hard work that I put in made their day better and their day easier, and that can only be good. So, yeah, I enjoy seeing that. That's my reward.
That's a pretty nice kind of pretty nice thing to be able to notice and see. We've toured through, you know, we've really skimmed the surface, but we've toured through sort of, I think we're up to about 40 years of history now. And I guess my last question is, you know, it's both a ridiculously big question and a maybe a small one at the same time. As you reflect back over all of that, you know, what are you conscious of, David, that RC has given you, that, you know, what have you learned or gained, or, you know, what's been the contribution of this sport, this hobby, to your life, you know, now as you kind of look back over all of it? What's RC given you?
Is the word everything too big?
No, it's not.
Career.
Hmm.
Opportunity to travel,
mm.
Some success, some results,
mm.
Some amazing friends around the world, mm. Memories,
mm.
Leading into a career, leading into house, mortgage, family, kids.
Mm.
It's all come from RC. Could I be more grateful to the people that put me where I'm sat today? No. Mm. Most of them aren't here anymore.
Mm.
So, yeah, the RC industry has been my world for pretty much the whole of my life.
Mm.
So, yeah, very thankful and very grateful.
Mm. Outstanding. David, thank you so much for taking, you know, a stack of time to, you know, both think about and prepare for, but also to chat today. It's been an extraordinary career, and there's a whole bunch of things that we've talked about, you know, and I'm just going to read back some of the notes I've made during our conversation, that sense of the good fortune of being surrounded by the right people at the right time, the capacity to pay attention and notice, you know, what was going on a racetrack or in the pits or around you, that commitment to wasting no energy, I think was a phrase that you used early on that you noticed in someone else and kind of tried to draw that out. The surrounding yourself with good people, the sense of winning Monday to Friday. I really like that phrase. I have a real sense from our conversation around a very deliberate, careful approach to going racing and what that's brought to you. But overall, the sense that, you know, has come out of our conversation is the recognition of the people around you, from your dad through, you know, right through to the guys that you're kind of going club racing with now, that, you know, all along the way pointing to the people that you've worked with that have sacrificed and contributed to one person's success in that sense, along the way picking up, let's call it 5 world championship wins and a bunch of races, but an extraordinary story. And thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us today.
Thanks, man. Thank you very much.
Folks, that's a little bit of the David Spashit story. There's a, you know, I mean, I have 1,000 more questions I want to ask, but we've got to let David get to sleep. And, you know, there's always more stories to be told. We'll be back next week. I did mention that it is, as we record this, the 1/10 scale world's warm-up is underway, and we have a special episode in the works for that. If everything works out, we'll be able to reflect on that event with someone that was there and maybe hear a few different voices around how that world championship event is shaping up later in the year. More interviews coming your way as well. We're having a great time. Love to hear your feedback. Anywhere you can pass us some feedback or review or rate or recommend or share what we're doing is much appreciated. For now, though, that's the David Spashit story. Thanks for joining us today, and we will be back next week.